Jai Gurudev, and welcome to our course on the Bhagavad Gita, in which we are celebrating the revival of total knowledge of life, as brought to light in Maharshi Mahesh Yogi's translation and commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. In Maharshi's introduction to the Gita, he writes, "The Bhagavad Gita is a complete guide to practical life. It will always be there to rescue man in any situation. It is like an anchor for the ship of life sailing on the turbulent waves of time." And Maharshi gives another beautiful description of the Gita later on in the text, saying, quote, "The Bhagavad Gita is the highest expression of divine intelligence understandable by man." The first thing one notices in looking at these two statements side by side is how intimately related they are to one another. The first bringing out the practical nature of the wisdom contained in the Gita, and the second pointing to its divine origin and status. The two come together when we realize that only divine intelligence is capable of providing a complete guide to practical life, and capable of rescuing us in any situation, as divine intelligence is the very source and basis of human intelligence, of human life. And fortunately for us, that divine intelligence has its home at the deepest core of our being, and we can access it, we can realize it, and we can live it fully in our lives. The Bhagavad Gita, the Song of Divinity, gives us the knowledge of how to accomplish this supreme goal, this supreme blessing in our life. And the knowledge offered by the Gita comes to us in the form of a conversation between one who embodies divine intelligence, Krishna, and one who embodies human intelligence, Arjuna, the seeker of knowledge, the seeker of truth. Maharshi once began telling the story of the Gita, and he began in the following way. He said, quote, "Once upon a time, there was someone named Arjuna and someone named Krishna. And Arjuna called him Lord because he was soothed by his words. And Arjuna surrendered because he had no other choice. And surrender means you don't doubt, but if you have a doubt, you express it." This is how Maharshi began the story of the 2.5 hour conversation in which Arjuna goes from a state of conflict and suffering to the state of enlightenment, the full realization of his cosmic divine nature. In the sequence of knowledge imparted by Krishna to Arjuna, the first thing Krishna teaches him is that the indwelling self is eternal, imperishable, indestructible. He tells Arjuna, "There never was a time when I was not, nor you, nor these rulers of men, nor will there ever be a time when all of us shall cease to be. As the dweller in this body passes into childhood, youth, and age, so also does he pass into another body. This does not bewilder the wise. Know that to be indeed indestructible by which all this is pervaded, None can work the destruction of this immutable being. These bodies are known to have an end. The dweller in the body is eternal, imperishable, infinite. Weapons cannot cleave him, nor fire burn him. Water cannot wet him, nor wind dry him away. He is uncleavable. He cannot be burned, he cannot be wetted, nor yet can he be dried. He is eternal, all-pervading, stable, immovable, ever the same. After giving Arjuna this understanding of the immortal nature of the indwelling self, Krishna then proceeds to teach Arjuna the art of transcending, the means by which he can directly experience for himself the indwelling self, the immortal, imperishable, indestructible being, the field of divine intelligence within us. And he begins teaching him the transcendental meditation technique, the practice as it's known in the world at this time, the practice of directly experiencing the indwelling self. He says, Krishna says, the Veda's concern is with the three gunas. Be without the three gunas, O Arjuna, freed from duality, ever firm in purity, independent of possessions, possessed of the self. And in Maharshi's commentary he says, Lord Krishna commands Arjuna, be without the three gunas, be without activity, be yourself. This is resolute consciousness, the state of absolute being, which is the ultimate cause of all causes. This state of consciousness brings harmony to the whole field of cause and effect and glorifies all life. Now, later on in the discourse, in chapter 6, Krishna describes this state of resolute consciousness, of absolute being, in very precise detail, in one sentence spanning the length of four verses that Maharshi calls the four pillars of the edifice of yoga. Let's hear these four verses now. Verses 20 to 23 of chapter 6. Krishna says, that state in which thought, settled through the practice of yoga, retires, in which, seeing the self by the self alone, he finds contentment in the self. Knowing that which is infinite joy, and which, lying beyond the senses, is gained by the intellect, and wherein established, truly he does not waver. Having gained which, he counts no other gain as higher. Established in which, he is not moved even by great sorrow. Let that disunion of the union with sorrow be known by the name of yoga, union. This yoga should be practiced with firm resolve and heart undismayed. Maharshi concludes his commentary to this verse 23, saying, these verses 20 to 23 form the four pillars of the edifice of yoga. They stand to remind those of every generation that it is not necessary to suffer in life, that life's goal is easy to attain, and that all aspirations are easy to fulfill. The way is by the inward march of the mind, by quietly locating the hidden universal being, a ray of whose eternal light is sufficient to dispel all the darkness of ignorance and shower down the blessings of Almighty God. Now, how this state of transcendental consciousness comes to be lived permanently is explained in the third chapter of the Gita, the chapter entitled The Yoga of Action. And Krishna begins teaching the art of action, the yoga of action, saying, as expounded by me of old, O blameless one, there are in this world two paths, the yoga of knowledge for men of contemplation and the yoga of action for men of action. And Maharshi describes these two paths in his commentary, saying, when the state of transcendental consciousness, or yoga, is supplemented by the process of thinking and discrimination in order to develop it into cosmic consciousness, the way is called the yoga of knowledge, Gyan Yoga. Whereas, when the state of transcendental consciousness is supplemented by action on the sensory level in order to develop it into cosmic consciousness, the way is called Karma Yoga, the path of action. These two types of yoga fulfill the needs of all men, whether contemplative or active. The experience of the transcendent during meditation is realization of only one aspect of reality, the unmanifested absolute aspect. For realization of complete truth, this experience has to go hand in hand with the experience of the manifested aspect, which is the relative phase of existence. In order that transcendental bliss consciousness may be lived at all times, it is necessary that it should not be lost when the mind comes out of meditation and engages in activity. For this to be possible, the mind has to become so intimately familiar with the state of being that it remains grounded in the mind at all times, through all the mental activity of thinking, discriminating and deciding, and through all phases of action on the sensory level. For this, in turn, it is necessary that the process of gaining transcendental consciousness through meditation and that of engaging in action should be alternated, so that transcendental consciousness and the waking state of consciousness may come close together and finally merge into one another to give rise to the state of cosmic consciousness, the state in which one lives bliss consciousness, the inner awareness of being through all the activity of the waking and dreaming states, and through the silence of the deep sleep state. This state of cosmic consciousness and the quality of action that comes with it is beautifully described in verse 48 of chapter 2, a very famous verse for us, a very cherished verse for us. Verse 48 of chapter 2 says, established in yoga, a winner of wealth, perform actions. Having abandoned attachment and having become balanced in success and failure. For balance of mind is called yoga. Balance of mind is called yoga. Let's hear a little from Maharshi's commentary to this verse. He says, yoga, or union of the mind with the divine intelligence, begins when the mind gains transcendental consciousness. Yoga achieves maturity when this transcendental bliss consciousness, or divine being, has gained ground in the mind to such an extent that whatever state the mind finds itself, whether waking or sleeping, it remains established in the state of being. It is to this state of perfect enlightenment that the Lord refers in the beginning of the verse when he says, established in yoga. Toward the end of the verse, he defines yoga with reference to action as balance of mind. This balanced state of mind is the result of the eternal contentment which comes with bliss consciousness. It cannot be gained by creating a mood of equanimity in gain and loss, as commentators have generally thought. Yoga is the basis of an integrated life, a means of bringing into harmony the inner creative silence and the outer activity of life, and a way to act with precision and success. Established in yoga, Arjuna will be established in the ultimate reality of life, which is the source of eternal wisdom, power, and creativity. And then Maharshi goes on to comment on this feature of balance again, balance of mind, where in the verse Krishna says, having become balanced in success and failure, for balance of mind is called yoga. And Maharshi makes the point, saying, a man cannot remain balanced in loss and gain unless he is in a state of lasting contentment. Here the Lord is asking Arjuna to get to that state of lasting contentment by a direct experience of transcendental eternal bliss. He is not advising a mere mood of equanimity. The state of transcendental bliss in eternal being is so self-sufficient that in its structure it is absolute. It is fullness of life, perfection of existence, and therefore completely unattached to anything in the relative field, completely free from the influence of action. When the Lord says, having abandoned attachment, he means having gained this state of eternal being, which is wholly separated and detached from activity. And when he says, having become balanced in success and failure, he means having reached stability in this state of eternal being. The regular practice of transcendental meditation is the direct way of rising to the state of transcendental being and stabilizing it in the very nature of the mind, so that, irrespective of the mind's engagements, in the conflicts inherent in the diversities of life, the structure of unity in eternal freedom is naturally maintained, and life is not lost to itself. This is so beautiful. Life is not lost to itself. This quality of balance of mind that is based, as Maharshi says, on a state of lasting contentment, is of particular significance to us as women. Balance of mind is, of course, essential for both men and women. But in the context of our endeavor to bring out the practical application of the Gita in the lives of women, we are approaching it from this perspective, of how we can meet the needs and challenges in the lives of women today. And considering the theme of balance of mind that is gained through the practice of yoga, the practice of transcendental meditation, we have a wonderful talk of Maharshi's that he gave in Toronto, Canada, in December of 1961. At that time, he gave courses for people in each area of society, a course for students, for those in the field of business, for retired people, for seekers of truth and for housewives and mothers. And now let's hear an excerpt from the talk given by Maharshi to the ladies on the course. This talk is found in the book 30 Years Around the World, Dawn of the Age of Enlightenment. And on hearing Maharshi's words, in which he addresses housewives and mothers, we want to keep in mind that the principles he's bringing out extend to the lives of all women, whether married or single, whether with or without children. Maharshi has reminded us on several occasions that born in the feminine gender, we are all by nature mother. Whether our motherhood is expressed in having children of our own or being mothers of our extended family, mothers of the world, we perform the same role of nourishing, supporting, uplifting, helping our near and dear ones to grow and to evolve to their fullest expression, their full potential of life. Let's hear now from this beautiful talk by Maharshi to the ladies attending the course in Toronto, Canada, in 1961. Maharshi says, quote, "The role of the housewife is probably the most difficult role in the world. She has to be like a neutral point in a magnet. It is the strength of the neutral point that keeps alive the strength of the positive pole and the negative pole. It holds them both together. The position of the housewife in the family, or the mother, is that she has to be the center of all the diversified opinions in the family. Children are of different types. They have different opinions. They have different minds. And the mother has to be so unmoved by any of them, holding all of them in their position, giving love, nourishment, guidance, and wisdom to all of them to develop. Just the position of a neutral point in a magnet. And this has to keep alive the positive pole and the negative pole, both alive. Otherwise, the quality of the positive and negative pole is such that both challenge each other. Both are opposed to each other. If set free, both will neutralize each other. None will be found. So many opposing views are found in the family and in the circle of friends. And the housewife has to be a center of all that. And that she is able to be only by being balanced within herself. The housewife has to be such that she bears the effect of the positive pole from one side, she bears the effect of the negative pole from the other side, and remains unmoved, unshaken, unchanged, uninfluenced in her own position. And then only the integrity of the family will be maintained. She has to be a silent witness to things, supporting everything, but not allowing things to pass through her onto the other side. If someone has said something, that is all with her only. She has not to pass it on to the other man. What she passes on to the other man is life, not any damaging influence on anyone, only supporting life. All the life-supporting influences are radiated from mother or from the housewife in the family, and not the damaging influence that has reached her from any other source. Like the neutral point in a magnet is her position, is the position of the housewife or the mother. Any mother or housewife who is able to hold her position as a neutral point always comes out to be a successful housewife and a successful mother, and the center of the integration in the whole family and in the whole society. What is necessary is for a mother or housewife to be absolutely established in that state of neutrality, which is the basis of life for different opinions and different minds. The neutral point radiates life to the negative pole, radiates life to the positive pole, holds them both together to be a good, powerful magnet. The whole credit of a magnet goes to a neutral point which has no magnetism in it. That is its strength. This state of the magnet is the state of life. So, hearing these words of Maharshi's, it becomes crystal clear that our first and foremost responsibility to ourselves and to our near and dear ones is to gain that state of perfect balance that Maharshi is describing here. And it's such a beautiful analogy that he gives, describing mother as the neutral point in a magnet, holding together the positive and negative poles, just like the mother in the family, or the mother in the workplace, or the mother in the circle of friends. Just like that, how she holds together and balances all the diverse tendencies within the family, within the group, all the different opinions and ways of thinking and behaving. She creates unity in diversity, balance between opposites. And as Maharshi said, this she is able to do only by being balanced within herself. And the fortunate thing is that as we continue the practice of our transcendental meditation, balance in life naturally grows. There are two verses in Bhagavad Gita that address this very point. They appear in verses 16 and 17 of chapter 6. Verses 16 and 17 come right in the middle of a series of verses that describe in great detail the inward march of the mind during transcendental meditation. It's very interesting that they should be placed right there, because they have an intimate relationship, an intimate dynamic with the whole process of the mind gaining stability in its source and basis in pure consciousness. Let's hear these two verses now, verses 16 and 17. Yoga indeed is not for him who eats too much, nor for him who does not eat at all, O Arjuna. It is not for him who is too much given to sleep, nor yet for him who keeps awake. For him who is moderate in food and recreation, moderate of effort in actions, moderate in sleep and waking, for him is the yoga which destroys sorrow. And in Maharshi's commentary to this verse, he defines yoga here as a union, he says. Yoga, union, is not only a state where the mind is fixed in divine consciousness. It is at the same time a state of individual life where every aspect of being is in perfect harmony with divine life and with life in nature. This state can only become permanent when the physical nervous system is sufficiently cultured to maintain it. The mind is in tune with the cosmic mind, or intelligence of God, while the functioning of the body sense itself in tune with the functioning of cosmic nature. The senses rise to the full height of their capability in order to experience and enjoy objects on the level of the divine play. But for body, organs, and senses to function in their most natural way, in full accord with the laws of nature, it is absolutely essential that the routine of life be moderate, that everything connected with food and activity remain within the limits of moderation, that the happy medium be maintained. And then he makes this point again. Here is the broad principle to be followed by one who wishes to live a life of inner peace and happiness, integrated with successful activity in the outside world. The body should be given the rest it needs, and one should engage in activity, but not to a state of exhaustion. Recreation should be taken in due proportion, so that it is neither too little nor too much. The Lord means that life should flow in a regular way, with a proper measure of activity, and with each thing given its just value. One should avoid excess in all things and be regular in meditation, for this will result in a state of inner peace and freedom from bondage. Now, let's just see this point that Maharshi brings out in terms of how this state of moderation and balance in life is gained in the process of transcendental meditation. He says, it should not be understood that being moderate of effort in actions is a prerequisite for yoga. This quality grows as the practice advances. It is not something which can be achieved without transforming the very nature of the person and his surroundings. As the practice of meditation advances, it effortlessly transforms both one's inner nature and the influence of one's surroundings. This automatically makes one moderate of effort in actions. And then he goes on to say, each condition given in this verse lays emphasis on moderation, which is most effectively brought about through the regular practice of transcendental meditation. Therefore, transcendental meditation can be regarded as the most effective form of recreation. Now, here we just heard Maharshi describe how this state of moderation and balance that is cultured through the practice of transcendental meditation results in the state of inner freedom, inner peace and freedom from bondage. And the theme of freedom is a very prevalent theme throughout the Bhagavad Gita. A state of freedom from all forms of bondage is naturally gained by virtue of the mind gaining stability in that state of eternal freedom within oneself. And there's a verse, it's the last verse we'll read today, which so beautifully expresses that state of life. That state of life in the state of enlightenment. And here it is, verse 24 of chapter 5. He whose happiness is within, whose contentment is within, whose light is all within, that yogi, being one with Brahman, attains eternal freedom in divine consciousness. And Maharshi says in his commentary, this verse presents a state in which life is wholly converged upon its innermost aspect and declares that state to be eternal freedom. Furthermore, it brings to light the sequence of stages on the way to realization. As the practice of transcendental meditation advances, inner happiness grows. With this, contentment grows. And at the same time, the experience of being becomes clearer. The inner light grows. With this, inner awareness grows, and with it the ability spontaneously to maintain being during activity. When one naturally begins to maintain the state of being in all states of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep, then one has attained eternal freedom in divine consciousness. And Maharshi goes on to say, the experience of variety in the world in no way takes him out of his liberation. No external light or knowledge of the relative world can in any way deprive him of his state. The Lord is saying that nothing in the world will be able to overshadow the perpetual freedom of a yogi in this resolute state. While he acts in the relative field of life, he is yet established in his own self. Divine consciousness is not opposed to life in the world, nor is consciousness of the relative world opposed to the divine consciousness of absolute existence. So, this verse that we just heard in Maharshi's commentary, they reveal to us the ultimate state of freedom in life, the perpetual freedom that nothing in the world is able to overshadow. It is the ultimate liberation to which the attainment of all outer freedoms has led us. The long history of striving and working to attain the external outer freedoms in life has brought us to the threshold of embracing the ultimate freedom that naturally belongs to us, eternal freedom in divine consciousness, the freedom that is our inherent birthright. Until we attain this freedom, we will never be satisfied with any lesser degree of freedom. If we remain in bondage to the small individual self, disconnected from the unbounded freedom and bliss of our indwelling self, we will continue to feel the yoke of oppression. But this bondage can be removed so easily by us, by directly experiencing the eternal freedom of the indwelling self. Now is the time to embrace that state of ultimate freedom that bestows the dignity, integrity, and self-sufficiency that naturally belong to us. The attainment of eternal freedom, eternal unity in divine consciousness, is the theme of the Song of Divinity, Bhagavad Gita. In closing, let's hear Maharshi's words from his introduction to the Gita. When, in speaking of the Gita, he says, it brings fulfillment to the life of the individual. When society accepts it, social well-being and security will result. And when the world hears it, world peace will be permanent. Unquote. It is our joy to do our part in bringing fulfillment to Maharshi's words that when the world hears it, when the world hears the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of Divinity, world peace will be permanent. We warmly invite all women everywhere to join us in this global initiative to create peace in our world family through hearing and living the message of eternal peace, eternal freedom, eternal bliss in divine consciousness. Jai Guru Dev. Shri Gurudev.